Truth. Let's go. Hello and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 79. Today is July 23rd, 2008. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue, because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the current overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind our trusted news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offers further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either ignored or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your televisions off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. The global elite see Canadian citizens as mere profit-creating consumers at best, and at worst, disposable muscle men to help steal the remaining pockets of natural resources they do not yet control. Don't fool yourselves by underestimating the importance of Canadian natural resources and our colonial past. Canada has long been a player in this international political system that favors the ultra-rich. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. Our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability. The prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. Good timing, Bruce Coburn. That's actions speak louder. Okay, what do we have for you this week? Show number 79. First off, I'm going to read a timely, important article written by Mike Finch. It is called Canadian Internet Service Providers Plan Net Censorship. Concerns grow that Canada's plan will wipe out alternative news sites and spread to the U.S. And listeners of this show know how important alternative and independent media is. So, very sad news. Well, I do have better news, however, an update on a story that I brought to you 2 weeks ago concerning cameraman Michael Barcelona, who was arrested by Vancouver police, that was June 12th, for filming the protest against former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell at the Vancouver Convention Center. Now, 2 weeks ago, I had James Flack from We Are Change Vancouver in a telephone interview reporting on this topic. So the good news there is charges will not be pressed. Okay, now last week I was out of town. My father is up visiting from California, and, well, a son took his father fishing on the West Coast, and it was a lot of fun. But in lieu of my not being in the studio live, I had two interviews, kind of best of interviews, I guess. One with Kevin Annett, the former minister turned whistleblower looking into Canadian genocide. That comes from show number 68. The second interview was with Richard Gage, AIA, the founder and architect, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So that was last week's show, and I guess I should plug my website where you can access those full shows. I did not archive last week's show because you can find them there at episodes 68 and 65. My website is unbossed.livejournal.com, and you can find out who was on the last episode and as well get a link to download it or to listen to it streaming. Now for the main meat of today's show. Very exciting show. I've been talking about this for a couple weeks now. Splitting the Sky, otherwise known John Bancor. I have a telephone interview set up with him. So who exactly is Splitting the Sky? This comes from Wikipedia. He is an activist struggling for justice for the indigenous peoples of the Americas. He has a very storied past. He's got a lot of history behind him. For example, he was the only man convicted as a ringleader of the infamous 1971 Attica State Prison Rebellion in upstate New York, in the course of which 43 inmates were killed. This event has inspired several movies. Also, shortly after that, he was listed by former UN Ambassador Andrew Young of the Carter administration as the number one political prisoner in the USA. That was 1975. Also, Splitting the Sky has founded an organization to unite all indigenous peoples into a great confederation called the League of Indigenous Sovereign Nations of the Western Hemisphere. In 1995, Splitting the Sky was he was the Sundance chief at Gustafson Lake, British Columbia, up near 100 Mile House, during the Gustafson Lake standoff. This incident turned into a major protest against the occupation of unceded native land. Splitting the Sky was an outspoken critic of the government's handling of the incident and was among those who raised the question of so-called Aboriginal title under international law. You can read in depth in his book, which he co-wrote with his wife, She Keeps the Door. It is a 653-page book entitled The Autobiography of Splitting the Sky, John Bancor Hill, From Attica Lake to Gustafson Lake. Splitting the Sky recently spoke at the Northwest Truth Convergence 2008 at the Peace Arch Park. 2 weeks ago, I had Wayne Pronte, who was one of the chief organizers of that event. So Splitting the Sky did, in fact, speak there. And you can watch on Google Video his lecture, his speech from the Peace Arch Park at this Northwest Truth Convergence. Very powerful stuff. I'm going to play a short piece from that. A little bit of satire humor involved in this as well, that only us fellow, conspiracy nuts would understand, right? So I think that is where we're going to go with this. Okay, this is entitled, if you want to listen to this or watch this speech prior to my posting it on my website, unboss.livejournal.com, go and do Google Video. Its title is Splitting the Sky Speaks Truth to Power. So here it is. When we come back, I'm going to read that piece on the internet as well as the update from We Are Change Vancouver on the arrest of the cameraman there. And of course, stay tuned for the Splitting the Sky interview, which will be in about 10 minutes. Okay, hang in there.
Insurance companies are multi-billionaires to team up with Larry Silverstein and Rudy Giuliani, who happens to be one of my own political nemesis, to sit down and say, once we blow these buildings and blame them on the Arabs, but 6 weeks beforehand, we'll go and we'll try to broker a deal so that we can collect insurance on these things. And written into the insurance clause that was finally settled was that, yes, you can collect only if you're attacked by a terrorist. Oh, so coincidentally, Lucky Larry hit the jackpot 6 weeks before 9/11. That was a coincidence. And if you think it was orchestrated from the inside as an inside job, you're nothing but a conspiratorial nut. Good. There's a bunch of nuts out here, and I'm a nut, too. So then when I started digging, I said, follow the money. Follow the money. Because in a capitalist society, that's what you do. You follow the money. You follow the money because that's all it is. It's money, money, resources, power, money, money, resources, power, power, money, money. terrorist, power, money, terrorist, power, money, terrorist, power, money. 9-11. We got to get rid of your constitutional rights. We got to take away your Patriot. We got to install the Patriot Act, number one. Number two, we got to make it safe for you against the boogeyman terrorists that are about to ready to take control of all of North America. We got to defend our borders. We got to stop all these terrorists from doing us in. We got to stop them. We got to take their civil liberties, and you're going to willfully give it to us. You're going to give it to us because we're going to protect you. Homeland Security's here for you, baby. And if you believe that, you're a nut. Good. Well, you're good nuts, and so am I.
Well done. Very impressive. I'm looking forward to this interview. I should mention Wayne Pronti of Fraser Valley 9/11 Truth helped out with that truth convergence and brought Splitting the Sky to that event. Okay, so where are we going to go now? Let's do this update from Travis Lupik of We Are Change Vancouver. Again, this is in reference 2 weeks ago. James Flack was talking about this incident just shortly after it happened, so this is kind of where it's at right now. So, British Columbia Crown Council has decided not to press charges against Michael Barcelona, a cameraman who was arrested by Vancouver police on June 12th. The arrest came while Barcelona was filming a protest against former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell at the Vancouver Convention and Conference Center. Powell was speaking inside. In a telephone interview, Barcelona said that he spoke to a prosecutor on July 14th and was told that the police department's recommendation to file charges was rejected. Barcelona claims that although he was invited to film the demonstration by a group protesting Powell's visit, he was acting as a journalist. Shortly after Barcelona's arrest, Constable Tim Fanning told the Strait, I'm pretty sure that's the Georgia Strait, that Barcelona was in the middle of the protest when he was arrested for resisting removal from the property. The Crown's decision to drop the matter has not led Barcelona to do the same. Barcelona told the Strait that he is still considering filing a complaint against Vancouver police and is meeting with lawyers for advice on how to proceed. He claimed that the police department's officers need to go back to school and learn the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, because Section Number 2 of the Charter guarantees freedom of assembly and freedom of the press. Section 9 protects against arbitrary detainment or imprisonment. Those are important things to know. So there we are. Charges are not being pressed. That is good, and stay tuned. I'll keep you posted if anything more becomes of this. So let's move on now to looking at the future of the internet and where is it going to go. Well, follow the money. I think that's where you're going to find it in a couple years from now. I'm going to fight pretty hard against that, helping get the word out, and it's up to you people to do something about that as well, right? Everyone listening has a vested interest. So here we are. The author is Mike Finch. This came out this week. I do not know where it was first published. The title is Canadian Internet Service Providers Plan Net Censorship. Concerns grow that Canada's plan will wipe out alternative news sites and spread to the U.S. So here we go. A net neutrality activist group has uncovered plans for the demise of the free internet by 2010 in Canada. By 2012, the group says the trend will be global. Bell Canada and TELUS, Canada's two largest internet service providers, will begin charging per-site fees on most internet sites, reports anonymous sources within TELUS. You can also read up on this story from Global Outlook. Quote, it's beyond censorship. It is killing the biggest ecosystem of free expression and freedom of speech that has ever existed. So says iPower spokesperson Reese Leeson. iPower was the first group to report on the possible changes. Bell Canada has not returned calls or emails. They're going to keep it quiet for a little while, I imagine, aren't they? But we're going to bust it open, and hopefully we can force our politicians to, well, act on our behalf, right, instead of the corporations. This is just so obvious. It's disgusting, isn't it? So carrying on. The plans made by the large telecom businesses would change the internet into a cable-like system, as in your television, the one I tell you to turn off, where customers sign up for specific websites and must pay to see each individual site beyond a certain point. Subscription browsing would be limited. Extra free fees would be applied to access out-of-network sites. Many sites would be blocked altogether. I wonder where the truth websites are going to go. The plan would, in effect, be economic censorship by only the top 100 or 200 sites making the cut in the initial subscription package. Such plans would likely favor major news outlets and suppress smaller news outlets, gee, you think, as the major news outlets would be free, of course, with your subscription, and alternative news sites would incur a fee for every visit. Quote, the internet would become a playground for billion-dollar content providers just like television is, says Layson. It wouldn't be possible for a few teenagers in their parents' basement to start a small site like eBay that then grows out to be the next big thing anymore. Right now, the internet belongs to those with the greatest ideas. In the future, it'll belong to those with the biggest budgets. With plans in Canada uncovered, iPower thinks that companies in the U.S. and other nations are also planning similar actions, I'm quite sure. We know that Congress in the States have been working on this for a while. Okay, so another quote from Leeson. By 2012, internet service providers all over the globe will reduce internet access to a TV-like subscription model, only offering access to a small, standard amount of commercial sites that require extra fees for every other site you visit. These other sites would then lose all their exposure and eventually shut down, resulting in what could be seen as the end of the internet, so says Leeson. Such a subscription plan could possibly restrict free speech far beyond even the current restrictions set by the governments of communist China. Not only would browsing be limited, but privacy would be invaded, as every website visited would likely be recorded on a bill in a manner similar to a phone bill. So why would the internet service providers institute such a plan? Well, one word, money. Okay, to wrap this up, the internet service providers are said to be confident that they can institute such plans through deceptive marketing and fear tactics. Well, of course, they're pretty damn good at that already, aren't they? And, quote, the internet will be more and more marketed as a place full of child pornography and other horrible illegal activities in order to get people onto the internet service provider's side once they start restricting and make it safer. You know, for that good example, H.R. 1955 labeling terrorists on the internet, and who did they include? Well, Richard Gage and his AE 9/11 Truth. A science-based website is now being lumped together with, perhaps legitimate terrorist organizations. Not good at all. So Leeson says that, quote, unless we really make a stand for this and make sure the mainstream media thoroughly covers the issue, the whole thing will be eased in with proper marketing to make sure that the most mainstream customers won't make a big deal out of it. They will only realize what was lost long after it's gone. I think we could say that about a couple things. I lived on Gabriola, and boy, you don't miss your water till your well runs dry. I think it's one of those stories. So there we are. We covered the update on the We Are Change incident and this sad potential future of independent websites and how important that has been to this truth movement. It's been phenomenal. You know that. You know, to watch the videos, certainly you can get the books from, well, as a matter of fact, you can pick up books here in Nanaimo at Faulkner Books, downtown at Port Place Mall. Stop into John, say, Raymond sent me. What do you have for me? Okay, what we're going to do now is because very shortly the Splitting the Sky interview will take place, I didn't want to interrupt that, so I'm going to get a campus community update out of the way nice and quick. Okay, thank you, Neil Young. During the entry, when I was describing what's going to be on the show, we were listening to Bob Dylan's Dirge. Very sad song, isn't it? And as is this one. So where are we going to go now? I'm going to take us to a song, and when I come back, I will have Splitting the Sky on the other end. So this is a song called State of the Union. The artist is David Ford. So stay with us. You are listening to CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. And we'll be back with Splitting the Sky after this.
Sweet dreams all met with derision. Well, this train, it was armed for collision. It's a shame, it's a shame, it's a shame.
And as promised, on the other end of the phone, I have Splitting the Sky. Now, Splitting the Sky, as I've been mentioning him the last couple of weeks, is an activist struggling for First Nations, Indigenous peoples throughout the Americas. The man does indeed have a long history of being at some, well, important yet frightening situations, and it seems Splitting the Sky has done his homework and is on the other line. Splitting the Sky, welcome.
Good to be here, Rick.
Yeah, thank you. So your most recent, I guess, public speaking was at the Northwest Truth Convergence at the Peace Arch Park.
Yes.
And I don't know if you knew or know this yet, but that is now on Google Video.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. How's that? How do you call that up?
Well, I'm going to link to it through my website, but also the proper title of it is Splitting the Sky Speaks Truth to Power.
You punch
that in on Google, and you're going to get a 38-minute speech by yourself. I played the short, satirical piece on, you know, if believing that 9/11 was an inside job, then I'm a nut, then I'm a nut. And so that's kind of where we're at. Would you like to perhaps tell our listeners about some of this, long and... This long past you have that has, you know, led you to where you are today, and it sounds like you've seen a lot of things that I hope no one else sees again, you know. So would you like to start off by telling us a little bit about your past, please?
Sure, why not?
Thank you.
Yeah, good evening to your guests or to your listeners. I've been around for quite a few years. My name is John Boncour. I was also known as John Hill. My Mohawk Indian name is Daka Juia, which means splitting the sky in the Mohawk language.
Okay.
I was born in Buffalo, New York, and I sort of years ago in 1952, I was born there. And when I was a young guy, about the age of seven, my father had passed away, and he... excuse me, he had worked at the U.S. Rubber, and there was they weren't given safety precautions.
Okay.
And all 11 guys that worked there died the next day from pain inhalation.
No kidding.
And subsequently, it wasn't too long after that that the Child Welfare Department just came and just snatched me and my brothers and sisters up. And from that point on, we were taken into a residential school.
Okay.
And we were there for quite a few years. And during that time, I had witnessed some very horrifying situations to the point where there was constant beatings and attempted sexual, rapes and things to this nature.
Yes.
As a young boy, you know, I fought these things. And... when I think about it now, it's still it's an emotional thing, but it's sort of the impetus that led me to, you know, trying to put a stop towards, you know, injustice and cruelty in this world.
Yes.
In any event, most of my life was spent in foster homes and reform schools. And when I was about 18, or just turning 18, I got in a situation where I had been living out in the streets for about 6 months, and it was wintertime, and it was, like, freezing out, and I was sleeping in hallways.
Is this still in northern New York
this
State?
This is in Buffalo, yeah.
Okay.
And so out of desperation one night, I attempted to rob a little mom-and-pop delicatessen. I didn't even have anything to rob her with, so I went in there and faked with my finger and in my pocket, and the lady screamed, and next thing you know, there was a couple of Italian guys come down and chased me out the building and grabbed me and got taken in by the cops. And I went to court for that. And before you know it, the first time I was ever convicted for anything or charged with anything, and what should have been a probation.
Okay. So
they ended up giving me 8 years for an attempted robbery.
Wow. With no weapon in your first
offense? No weapon or nothing, and nothing stolen.
Hmm.
And so the next thing you know, I found myself in New York State's penal system. And eventually I would end up doing 16 of the different prisons. And while I was in there, I was involved in a 1971 Attica Rebellion. Many of your listeners probably heard of it. Many probably haven't heard of it.
Sure.
But it's a historical thing that's been, you know, documented in movies and documentaries and hundreds of books and accounts of what happened in 1971. And what happened was is that the prison conditions were so terrible that people were working for, like, slave wages, 62 cents a day per capita.
Okay.
People were being brutally murdered and, you know, beaten severely, you know, for not adhering to the prison regulations, the administration. And so in the long run, there was so many years of this kind of abuse that was going on. Eventually what happened is that an incident occurred in the prison yard and between a black and a white man, and they were scrimmaging for a football game, and this lieutenant came out and with a bunch of guards around him and said to lock the nigger up. And so, like, I was 19 years old at this point, and I was working out on some weights, and a friend of mine just said, I was pushing some weights up, and a friend of mine says, geez, did you see that? So apparently this black guy just said he wasn't going to go be put in solitary confinement, because when you go to solitary confinement, a lot of people, man, that bucked the administration then would come up mysteriously dead, saying that they had committed suicide.
Okay, yeah.
And so black man struck the lieutenant, and before you know it, everybody came to his solidarity. Now, that was kind of unheard of. It wasn't too long before that we had heard about the murder of this really prominent political prisoner by the name of George Jackson, who was a black prisoner and sold that prison in California.
Okay.
And he was a pretty famous writer. And so, and this was during the peak. At that time, there was like this was the peak of the anti-war movement, the Vietnam War, the rise of the Black Panthers. The American Indian movement wasn't too far. The women's movement and labor movement.
You know, civil rights, yeah.
There was a strong activist time for social unrest during that time, and so the consciousness was very high in terms of people becoming involved politically. And so I got caught up in that flow, and one thing led to another, and when they surrounded this lieutenant and these guards, and then basically said we weren't going to let them lock them up, and they promised that they wouldn't lock them up. So the next morning, that night we heard that they locked them up, and the next morning we came out of our cells and confronted the administration and asked them why they had locked those guys up. And there was a big melee the evening before. You know, people were throwing cans out their cells, and there were flyers being started in different cell blocks.
Okay.
So that morning, anyway, so they had locked the doors, you know, so nobody could go out to the yard for the rec period before you go to your assigned duties.
Okay.
Mind you now, did you get paid 2 cents a day for working in the sweatshops. And so if you talk about sweatshop labor, the prison system is one of the biggest facilities in the world that is totally exploiting inmate labor. You could call it compulsory, you know, slave labor in the 20th century. Yeah. So in any event, next thing you know, that this guard said, or this captain said he didn't know, and there was a bunch of guards there, and somebody threw a shot at one of them, hit the captain in the face, and before you know it, the whole place was taken. You know, they broke into a into an insurrection, and we seized the prison, and we held the prison for 5 days. Now, I was accused. There was a guard that was inside the gates. Now, in the four quarters. Now, there's the gateways, and in the four quarters, the only way you could get through the other side of the buildings was to get the keys and open up all the gates.
Okay.
Well, the three guards were inside of that gate then, so there was like the gate was maybe 20 feet wide, and inside of the tunnels, and they were, you know, they were built right into the to the walls, to the prison walls. And it was about 60 of us started shaking and pulling on this gate, just constantly, you know, shaking it and back and forth. Before you know it, we ripped the gate out of the wall.
Right.
As the gate fell, it hit this guard in the head, you know, by the name of William Quinn. But being an activist, being one of the prominent activists then at the age of 19, and the administration charged me with killing this guy because of, the gate fell on his head. But they said that I had hit him over the head with a stick, which was not true.
Okay, okay.
Anyways, the famous, we held the prison for 6 days, or
okay,
for
now,
5 days.
You had hostages, I'm guessing?
Yeah, there was 50 hostages.
50?
Yeah, we held them for 50, we held them for 5 days.
Okay.
At the end of the fifth day, we were negotiating with Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller was the governor then.
Of New York,
and with a bunch of observers, and you know, from the state, you know, with representatives from outside, the media came in, and we had you know, live media coverage for the very first time in history. You know, that the media, the cameras came inside and you know, covered everything live.
Yeah.
So, anyways, Rockefeller refused to grant amnesty for the guard that had died, this guard that I was charged with, and that was one of Stickling points. And then we asked to have 28 demands, or 31 demands total, to change the conditions at prisons. A lot of us were conscious to the point where we said, well, you know what, we don't want to make misery comfortable. You know, we don't believe in repression as being a comfortable thing.
Okay.
So we totally believe that if you would change the whole socioeconomic structure, you wouldn't need prisons in the first place. If, you know, if the government met the needs of the people and the people, man, were free to, you know, to meet their needs, most of the crimes that are committed are all property related, 75%. So anyways, the long and short was, some of us said, man, the hell with that, you know, we want transportation to a non-imperialistic country. Get us out of here now.
Yeah.
In exchange for the hostages.
Huh.
Well, Rockefeller sent in 1,000 state troopers and National Guards.
Okay.
They got on top of the buildings, and they issued an ultimatum.
What was the size of Attica? What was the total inmates at when it was full?
Yeah, there was 1,000 of us.
Okay, okay.
And so they had 1,000 state troopers. And
mano to mano, it sounds.
Excuse me?
Mano to mano. You were really even, I bet. The two sides were even.
Yeah, but we didn't have guns.
No, of course, I'm
and
joking.
They were all armed with fully automatic rifles, including shotguns that used 00 buck, you know, shells, and they also had 270, you know, elephant hunting rifles, sharpshooter rifles, 250 mags. So these guys were like prepared, and they had gas masks and raincoats on that morning, September 13, 1971. They sent a helicopter up in the air, and the helicopter flew over, and, you know, we were posturing, you know, by holding, you know, the hostages at knife point.
Okay.
You know, but there was a psychological warfare. You know, we never believed that they would come in and retake the prison, or they would forfeit any of their own by shooting into the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when this helicopter flew over it, dropped four canisters, huge barrels of CN4 gas that was used in Vietnam. It was so lethal that they banned it, in use in warfare, according to the 1906 Geneva Conventions.
Yeah.
Well, this gas permeated and started burning the skin and burning people's eyes. And all of a sudden, they just came in from all directions, and they just started shooting thousands of rounds of bullets. And in a matter of 5 minutes, they had spent over 27,000 rounds of bullets, and you could, that morning, 43 people were murdered in cold blood. 80 people were wounded and maimed for life.
And how many guards were injured?
The 11 guards that were in there that were dressed up in inmates, we had them in inmates' clothes.
Okay.
11 of those died by state police gunfire.
Okay. And how about the state police? Any fatalities?
Nobody
there?
Died from them.
Okay.
Not one state police or National Guard died as a result of the assault. It was a total slaughter. It was a turkey shoot.
Yeah.
And we basically had given up. I mean, we just, you can't fight bullets with, baseball bats. And so, so that's a historical thing, Attica.
Right. Now, there's been a couple movies, some with, big names, but Morgan Freeman and Samuel Jackson.
Yep.
I was unable to get a hold of those. I couldn't find them in my smaller city.
Yep.
What's the gist? What side are they showing on that?
Well, it's kind of balanced. It was a good movie.
Okay.
There's another one with Samuel L. Jackson and Anne Heche, and it's called Against the Wall. That was sort of one of the hostages' story.
Okay.
John Lennon wrote a song. John Lennon was a staunch supporter of the Attica Brothers. That was us.
Okay.
And in 1971, when I was charged with killing this corrections officer, and Bill Kunstler was my trial lawyer, and Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, was my appeal lawyer.
Nice.
And John Lennon and Yoko Ono had put together a big benefit concert for us at the Autobahn. One of the theaters, I forget, I'm saying Autobahn, but it wasn't the Autobahn.
In what city?
In New York City.
Okay.
I forget the name of the theater, but it's up in Harlem. But Apollo, the Apollo Theater.
There you go, yeah.
And that was the first time that he had sung the song Imagine. He dedicated it to me. It was the first time.
Wow.
Because I was on trial. So, if you plug in John Lennon, Attica, and you can also hear their song on their album called Attica State. So anyways, moving down there, so there was 61 of us indicted. Eventually, after there was a big commission, Rockefeller was vying for the president of the United States, vice president, under Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
And there was Senate commission hearings as to why he should or shouldn't be president. They go through the whole rigmarole, posturing all the time.
Yeah.
And in any event, there was hearings that many of the senators were saying that it was a senseless slaughter that Rockefeller had ordered. And Rockefeller was trying to get the head of the Manhattan District Attorney's, the head of the Bureau of Criminal Investigations of New York, trying to get him to suppress any future evidence going into to a second grand jury that was investigating the murders that were committed by the state troopers.
Okay.
And subsequently, they were Rockefeller was one of the guys that was doing the investigation was a guy by the name of Malcolm Bell. He wrote a book called Turkey Shoot, but he had written a 60-page document to the New York Times saying that Rockefeller was trying to systemically tamper with jury, right? Jury tampering by suppressing any evidence of wrongdoing on behalf of the state police. And so eventually there was a commission that came by. They released this, they wouldn't release that report until after my trial. 60 days after my trial, they released a report. Then for 4 years, they went through this big commission hearings about Rockefeller suppressing all this evidence, trying to get Simonetti. The long and short of it was is that this commission made recommendations to the succeeding governor, that was Hugh Carey, and asked him to and made the recommendations to one, complete, to grant a blanket amnesty to all state troopers for their involvement in Attica. Well, whoop-de-loo. The other one was to drop the pending indictments against the rest of the Attica brothers. Mm. And I'm the only person who was convicted for anything already and had done 4 years with seven attempts to murder me while I was in prison. Mm. And I lived through each one of those attempts. And then there was a recommendation that I be released on parole, you know, as a result of, as a commutation. Now, there's a difference between a commutation, which is a recommendation for parole, and a governor's recommendation you should be released. Or there's an all-out pardon, which makes you not, it means you don't have to be released to parole, it's an unconditional release. In my case, there was two state senators by the name of Dale Volcker and Rolf Marino that were putting pressure on the acting chairman of the New York State Parole Board not to release me. And for the first time in the history of New York, I was given 2 more years on the strength of a governor giving a recommendation for release. Well, by the time I went back for the second parole date, for the next hearing, I was released, but I was considered the scapegoat of Attica, the fall guy, the total fall guy for Attica.
This would have been in 72?
Yeah, that would have been. No, I didn't get out till 1979.
Okay. Okay.
I didn't get out till 79.
Well, and where did you spend your time?
Well, then I moved back to New York City.
No, I mean prior from Attica up to 79, where were you?
Oh, I was in a number of different prisons. They kept moving me from one prison to the next prison because I was seen as a revolutionary status symbol. And anywhere I went, I constantly organized people not to accept the prison conditions as they were. And so they didn't give me a lot of time to organize. So they would move me. They had us on the bus. They had us on the boat.
Okay.
You know, from one prison to another prison, because they didn't give you too much time, man, to really, you know, to inject your thoughts.
Yeah.
Or to start teaching and educating people politically the whole, you know, the socioeconomic political system.
Sure.
And so subsequently, I did all that time, I got out in 79, and sort of fast-forwarding there a little bit. I was involved. I was the Eastern Regional Coordinator for the American Indian Movement. I started an organization called the League of Indigenous Sovereign Nations. LISTEN was the acronym.
Okay.
And we're trying to confederate all indigenous sovereign nations into one grand confederation, sort of symbolic, sort of resembling the Confederation of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy.
Okay.
And so under the principles of the Gayanagoa, which is the great law. And so, as you know, I mean, I was trying to confederate nations into this grand confederation and demand a seat in the UN General Assembly with one vote and one voice.
Okay, so that was what you were shooting for, was a voice in the international stage.
Yes. And I organized 12,000 people in a massive rally in 1992, the 500th year anniversary of colonial inception and deception,
yeah.
And since the time of Columbus. And 12,000 people came to the Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza right in front of the United Nations, and we made this. It was a grand event, and it was a very powerful event. And the League still is actively, you know, developing its agenda here towards confederation. And it's important to understand that, you know, Six Nations, you know, many of the principles of democracy were founded, predicated on the democratic principles that we practice out of one of the oldest living constitutions in North America for sure. Over 700 years, this Constitution was given to us by a great Huron prophet and political statesman by the name of Daganoweda.
Yeah, you don't hear that too often in the college history books, do you?
No, you don't. And you know what? But you will. You will hear more and more about it all the time because we're going back to the roots. I mean, the whole concept of the two-thirds majority vote came from the Gayanagoa, the Great Law. The concept of the people's referendum came from the Great Law. Women's equality, the Great Law. All these concepts, the right to national self-defense, all these came from the Great Law, the oldest constitution. So, in a sense, and it's something that the powers that be, the member states of the United Nations, well, let's call it the United Member States, because it really is a consortium of nations, man, that just states that basically are the superpowers of the world, and so it's the big rich man's club. And it's the ones that dominate and control policies internally and externally,
yeah,
internationally and abroad.
Yeah, we're almost getting into something here where your work in investigating 9/11. You are a 9/11 truth activist as well as a truther in another sense. But I know that one of your philosophies is follow the money.
Yes.
And it's starting to come out here. And I would like you to speak on what you've uncovered in the 9/11 sphere later. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to necessarily interject, but it sounds like you're touching on something that hopefully we'll get into more in depth.
Yep. Well, yeah, I'll tell you what, we'll fast forward right to 9/11.
Okay.
Now, the one other thing is in 1995, I met my wife, who's a beautiful Cree woman by the name of she keeps the door, Sandra Brudem. We have four kids. Angela is our oldest, Dylan is our next, Rainbow and Che.
Okay.
And I met her at a conference on economic independence in Edmonton in 1993.
Okay.
And by 1994, I came up here to live, and I've been up here ever since.
All right.
I left New York.
You left New
in
York
1995,
for
I was one of the principal leaders of the standoff up at Gustavson Lake, and I can articulate that a little bit, maybe at another time. But for the time being, what's necessary, what I'm sort of setting the background here is I wrote a book with my wife, and it was called The Autobiography of Splitting the Sky, from Attica to Gustavson Lake.
Okay.
And so I tell all these stories, and I document all this history. If anybody's interested, by the way, I might as well inject now, you can contact me at splittingthesky@yahoo.com, and I will be willing to, more than willing to send you a copy of the book for sale. Or you can call me at my home number when I get back. It's 250-679-7743. Or while I'm here for the next week at my friend's house, 604-255-1369.
Right.
I'll give you these numbers again before
sure.
I close the show.
And that's in Vancouver?
This is in Vancouver.
I'm
at my friend's until probably at least one more week.
Okay.
And then, like I say, you have both numbers. But in any event, there was a young fellow who had seen one of the movies that documentaries we had put together about what really happened up at Gustavson Lake, and it was called Above the Law. And he had seen it in New York. Comes to find out that the guy that had saw this movie was the nephew of one of the Rockefellers, who was a very wealthy young guy.
Sure.
And he invited me to bring the book, to bring my family and myself out to New York, and to do a book launching on my autobiography here. And so we graciously accepted. We're going to do a benefit concert at a club in Soho Village in New York. And so when we got there, we stayed a block away from the Twin Towers.
So let me back up just a sec. A big part of the Attica story is Rockefeller governor.
Yes.
And his nephew is footing the bill to bring you to promote your book.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
Yeah. And, oh, there's more Rockefeller. When you read my book, ironically, there's more Rockefeller connections even up to the Gustafson Lake.
Okay.
So, but in any event, that's another time, another talk. Or just get the book. And so, anyways, I get to New York to promote the autobiography with my family. And we're staying at the Marriott Hotel, right next to the Twin Towers.
Okay.
I go up on the 26th floor, and we're there for 10 days. This guy's footing the bill. And we're there for 10 days on the day, on September 10th, 2001. We had had the concert, and I just had this very eerie feeling. The night before, on the 9th, I was kind of looking outside on that floor. Every night I could see the Twin Towers, and it was just that one night it looked particularly eerie. And there was like this huge cloud around it, and then there was this light on top of the cloud that was it was just this very eerie feeling over there. I had thought to take my kids up there and go to the top of that, but I was going to spend another day and go up on the 11th, ironically. But something told me I had to get out. I also had to go and do a speaking engagement, a talk at McGill University.
So we're talking about September 11, 2001.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, so I want to make that clear.
Oh, yes, we are.
Yeah.
And so on September the 10th, I says, well, you know what, I'm going to say, look, we're going to check out, we're going to head up, and I'm going to stay at my sister's at Buffalo, and then for a night, and then head over to Montreal to do this talk at McGill University on the 14th. Anyways, so we got out of town. By the time we got up to Montreal the next morning, and we're in a very heavy sleep, we heard about what happened at Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you should know that that I thought one of the people that was highly involved as being one of the heroes of what happened at 9/11. Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
Rudy Giuliani, when he was running for mayor, a second term against this black woman named Councilwoman. I can't remember her last name right now. Anyway, he was going against this Messenger. Ruth Messenger was her name. When I had first gotten out from Attica, they had a fundraiser for me and my previous family, and Annette Rubenstein was the housemate to this woman, Ruth Messenger, and Village Voice had run an article that they had put this fundraiser for me. Well, Giuliani tried to use me as to say against her, to say that she was hosting a party for the Rocker, or she was hosting a party for a cop killer.
Yeah.
And so she tried to do what was called, you know, I don't know if you remember the Willie Horton incident where Dukakis was running up against George Bush. So they tried that whole smear and disinformation, campaign in order to cripple your opponent.
Yeah, it's pretty effective when you got the media on your side.
Yeah, it is. And, of course, when I was here, I was in Vancouver then during going to the trials of the Gustafson Lake, and, the media here had interviewed me on behalf of CBS and asked me what I thought, and I basically told Giuliani to kiss my rear, and that he was the slimiest politician out there, and that there was something very cloudy about his activities relative to 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, but of course that comes later. But in any event, I just want you to know that Giuliani, I believe, just like others have believed, is intricately involved, is an inside player for being involved in the inside job on 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he played the hero
he
really
played the
well.
Hero, but he's really a total zero, and we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
All right, so I figured, okay, so after 2001 and when the Twin Towers came down, to me it was like, just like the rest of the world, in total shock. But I was one of the first people that came out. Like, for instance, when Harry Fleischer came out on TV and basically said right after we watched Bush you know, doing a goat story and not really getting up too fast and moving on too fast, you know, Vice Secret Service moving them out to get them out of potential harm's way, which is all just a false flag hooliganism. And it was just all a staged event. It was a false flag operation, and there's no question in my mind. So I was when I was asked to do a talk show in New York on WBAI, and I was on Teokus and Ghost Horse, the first Americans, his show, First Voices. And I said, you know something, I've studied these people so well, I know how they work. I said, you know, the Twin Towers was nicknamed David and Nelson Rockefeller. That was the nicknames.
I didn't know
now,
that.
Now, I knew for a fact that both of those buildings, like in 1993, I knew that the FBI had tried to have that building blow up.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to have blow it up in 93. But I also knew that there was this big debate, there was this big lawsuit going on, and Rockefeller was trying to get paid for the, and the Port Authority, they were trying to get the Port Authority to pay the insurance cost for the asbestos poison, the asbestos that those buildings were laced with. They were two white elephants.
That's right.
And I said on the airwave, after Ari Fleischer told everybody in the world, be careful what you see and be careful who you said it, I basically told Ari Fleischer to kiss my ass, point blank. And I said it on the air, point blank. I said, what we're talking about here, you don't tell people, you know, to terrorize the minds of people. I said, because if I was David Rockefeller and if I was Larry Silverstein, and I had bought, why would I buy two white elephants weeks before, before this incident came down, when there was a clause in the lawsuit or in the leasing of those buildings that basically said the only way you would get paid on insurance levels is if some kind of incidents of a terrorist activities had happened to it. So, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, well, look, this is like people, somebody is setting up an incident so that they can get paid. This is a big, large insurance scam and scandal that went down. It would have cost them $1 billion to set up scaffolds and break those twin towers down and get the contamination, the asbestos contamination out of there. And instead of doing that, I said on the airwave, and the first person to say anything about it, I said it in New York City to millions of people listening live, I said that if I owned those buildings, and if I wanted to, if I owned those buildings and I wanted to get rid of this liability, what I would do is I would weeks in advance plant explosives in that place, because my common sense, my eyes, when watching TV, looking at those buildings go down, tells me that those buildings were brought down by implosions. I could see the squibs, and I could see all of the bombs going off. My brother was one of the Mohawk workers, was an iron, he was a foreman. He was one of the iron workers on that building, just like many Mohawk Indians. My people, we were there. We built that place. Yeah. We built those towers.
Well, the firefighters said the same thing. They heard explosions.
The firefighters said the same things until they were given a gag order.
Yeah.
They were gagged, and then they lost their heart to speak, to continue to speak, because they're afraid they're going to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
You see, but I have nothing to lose by telling the truth. The only thing I have to lose is my life. And I've lived a very long life. And I'm not afraid of dying for telling what I see is the truth. So when I said this over the airways, I said, what I saw, if I was David Rockefeller, I said, what I would do is I would implode those buildings, bring them down, kill so many thousands of Americans that are in that buildings. Mostly, the very first people in those buildings were mostly your workers that were in there. You didn't even really have the higher echelon, organizers and employers there. Majority of the people were the workers, you know, the grassroots ground people, the Puerto Ricans, the blacks, you know, yeah. The indigenous. These were the low levels men that were first going into those buildings. So if I was going to sacrifice, I'd sacrifice all the lowly ones, bring those buildings down, blame it on some boogeyman from out that lives in a cave in Afghanistan, throw his name out there, get all of these knuckleheads in America, man, that are just react automatically as emotional robots, and get them out there, man, ranting and scranting and screaming, man, for justice, and getting out there and starting to beat up every Muslim they could see, and then get the police state, man, to start arresting and detaining and sending people out on flights for extraordinary rendition and sending them to so-called torture-friendly countries to start extrapolating information. It's the rise of a police state. What I would do is I would stop. I would demand that the people, man, give up their civil liberties and then get ready and prepare themselves, man, to get the military forces to get to launch an invasion into the Middle East, because I've got my eyes set on the oil. I got my eyes set on the resources. If I was David Rockefeller, it would give me an excuse, man, to launch an invasion into Afghanistan, to seize control of a pipeline, to run all that natural gas, man, from the Caspian Sea all the way down into Pakistan. It would give me the right to set up military bases in Afghanistan on the border of Russia and China. It would give me into Iraq. We depose the leader that's trying to nationalize the oil instead of giving it, turning it all over to the Western Consortium of oil developers. We would seize the oil supply. We would down the so-called. We would down another so-called depot, and we would seize control of the country. And then from there, we would begin to amass another invasion into Iran and into any country, man, that in Venezuela that is resource rich in its oil. Yeah. And that's what Dick Cheney was all about, and his national energy policy: energy equals security, security equals energy.
Yeah, well, years earlier, you know, the Grand Chessboard is considered by many to, you know, lay down this document.
And that was the mother document. That was the father document. The Grand Chessboard is the mother of the PNAC program, the Project for a New American Century.
Yeah.
So basically, this is what my intuition said. Everybody was aghast that I had the guts to say this. This is what my gut feeling just said. From that point on, all I've done is connected all the dots of everything that I knew intuitively,
yeah,
what my common sense told me.
Yeah.
But you see, my common sense is not the common sense of most people. It's because I have seen how these people think, act, and do in real time. Because I've lived through the beast in the bowels inside the intestines of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I says, well, listen, okay, if when I heard that there was these put option stocks, this gamble that went on for short sales, betting 100-1 that these various corporations were going to fail, United Airlines and many others. I said, if you want to know who the killer was, and that people capitalized to the tunes of billions of dollars off of people's dying and these corporations going down as a result of the calamity, the catastrophe that was initiated by the peoples of the grand, you know, by the implementers of the Grand Chess Game. So I started to look into this. I found out that the number three man of the CIA, Buzzy Krongard, he was in a position, but he was appointed by Bush to investigate these short sales, when in reality, he was one of the recipients of the short sales. And I'm saying, okay, there was, I'm wondering, why did the Securities Exchange Commission, why did they not release the name of the companies?
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened there was a guy in Vancouver who's a writer by the name of Ian Mulgrew, and he happened to do an article, and I read the article about those short sales, and he listed those companies. Well, I hand-wrote every one of them. I didn't have a computer with a printer, and I hand wrote it off the computer.
What year was this?
This was in 2003 or something like that.
Okay.
So I got the whole list, and I kept that for years. Now, what had happened is that the Canadian Securities Exchange Commission had got a copy of that list, the 38 corporations, and I got those I got the name of those corporations, and I started investigating them. And so then I find out that this is this the 9/11 that bogus commission man was saying, yeah, well, there was a list of corporations, but that information is not necessary here because it just isn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, it's just the most important people, because when I looked at those 38 corporations that included Merrill Lynch, that included Citibank, Citigroup, number one bank, that includes a whole list, you know, all of the corporations, yeah. Goldman Sachs, and I looked at all these different corporations that benefited, and found, and I looked at it because I heard about some guy by the name of Bergen, who worked at the Chicago Board of Federal Reserve Board. And he was investigating 9/11 short sales. And they had fired him from doing that job. So I was asking, why, and also there was an article written about the National Security Agency was suppressing suppressing investigations of any Americans who might have been involved in 9/11. Because, why? Because they might be sued. Well, when do they really care about that? When did it, were they ever worried about being sued? Why was the FBI being suppressed? Why were all these different agencies being suppressed from investigating?
Yeah.
And I said, well, somebody's trying to hide the fact that somebody high in the echelon of banking and the echelon of wealth was, in fact, behind 9/11. And what I found out eventually is that the people that were involved in 9/11 were basically that list of 38 corporations. When I asked myself, well, why did that guy get fired from the Federal Reserve Board in Chicago? And I said, who owns the Federal Reserve? I Googled it in, and when I can finally come up on it, I find out that all of the corporations that were listed on this 38 list of the Securities Exchange Commission, most of those corporations were also aligned with corporations that are owned by both by the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers.
Okay. Yeah.
I says, well, Jesus, isn't this convenient?
Hmm.
Then I come to find out that later on that there was a guy by the name of Pete Peterson, who was the head of the New York Federal Reserve for a while, the president, and also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And in investigating him, I see that he was the head of a group called the Blackstone Group. Now, the Blackstone Group was a consortium of insurance companies that had put up $111 million with Larry Silverstein to his $16 million, Silverstein who bought the Twin Towers, and they put up that money to secure the lease. Now, why would this Peterson, along with another fellow by the name of Hank Greenberg, who was this mogul billionaire, who is tied into this insurance company, American Insurance Group, which is one of the corporations that is on that list of recipients of the short sales. So, in other words, you have Mark Greenberg, you got his son Jeffrey, you got his son Alan, you got Pete Peterson, you got the Blackstone Group with Silverstein, Larry Silverstein, putting together, knowing that those buildings were going to be imploded. They went and somehow they had all of their all the people on Wall Street, they had their people out there betting to the tunes of billions of dollars on the short gambles that these stocks were going to fall with the blood that fell that same day.
That's right.
Now, I eventually was reading an article. I read an article by some woman. I think it's got it right here. There's a woman named Vlada Sinjelic, who's a Serbian woman, who wrote an article called The Rothschild Octopus. And when I read all of the this 14-page document, I find that there was one person who was very intricately involved in being a point man for the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, and that is a guy very well known by the name of George Soros.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out, I read at the end of this article, it's called Branko Chemvinsky, Soros's Puppet. Now, when I read this, it says Soros is involved in a Macedonian mobile phone company, MTV, via Stonebridge Communications Company, in which he has stocks. Incidentally, MT is indirectly controlled by the Rothschilds through the Blackstone Group. Now, what does that do? This automatically ties Mr. Soros in with Pete Peterson and the Blackstone Group, a major financial investment group which was founded in 1985 by their agents Peter George Peterson and Stefan Schwarzman, a Kazar. Both of them have previously made careers in Rothschild branch offices, Lehman Brothers, and Cohn Loeb. These are also on the control. The Lehman Brothers is also on the control list of 38, which also incorporates the Hungarian mobile phone company Matva. The owner of the massive Macedonian mobile phone company MT, T-Mobile, is the second largest mobile phone company in Macedonia. So what we have here, Mr. Soros, who's directly tied in with Mr. Kissinger, who represents Mr. Rockefeller and the Rothschilds, who have a history, and Soros, who has a history of setting up puppets in countries in Serbia and orchestrating campaigns. Soros was financed by financed Bill Clinton first and second elections, bankroll them. So Soros had Clinton, you know, go through this whole thing about ethnic cleansing in Albania in order to justify the kill so that they could do these bombing raids and they could steal the trillions of dollars from the Serbs while deposing a so-called depot. You see, so this is the way the game is played. Soros made his billions, man, by creating the hedge funds on Wall Street on short sales. If you look at every major person that was, every single person that was running for the U.S. presidency, including Obama today, every one of them are financed by the same corporations that were on the short list of the SEC, the control list of 38. So we're all being bankrolled and we're all being bombasted and we're basically all being controlled by the same bankers, Rothschilds and Rockefellers, and these are the gangsters with all their hitmen that were behind 9/11. This was an inside job, and these are the guys that are bankrolling the current presidency and the presidential run. Every one of them, Democrat and Republican, receives finances from these same people.
Yeah, yeah, the ones the Ron Pauls and the Kucinichs they sure as heck aren't given equal time on the airways, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, but then again, now we have to ask ourselves, well, if Dennis Kucinich is now talking about following the money, right? He is talking about following the money to find out who was behind 9/11. Well, somebody ought to send this information to him right there, because this is information he needs to have.
Okay, there we are. Yeah. You know what? I'm going to have to take a break. Do you want to do that now, or do you want to wait a couple minutes?
Yeah, well, let's take a break. I need to get me some water.
Okay, very good. Why don't you plan to come back in 3 or 4?
I will.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, fascinating discussion. Follow the money. 9/11, the put options. We could also add that the official story, again, following this money trail, who funded that $100,000 money wire to Mohammed Atta? Again, the official commission said, well, it's not really important, is it? So that's two instances where the money is very important. And, the people who wrote the commission, do this cover-up, do not follow the money trail. So we have been listening to Splitting the Sky, John
Hello.
Bancorp.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
is this John again?
It is.
Oh, okay. I'm just chatting away. I'm going to read some announcements. So you can just hang cool in the background if that's
okay.
All right. Thanks, John. Okay, that was Splitting the Sky right there. However, we're going to move into the Islands Folk Festival, and then I'll be back with a couple others. Let me tell you, you're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. This is the Unbought and Unbossed show. Okay, let's carry on with the campus community updates, which I'm very privileged to bring you every week with CHLY. And, if we're going to lose, we have to fight so hard to change our politicians so they don't sell out the internet to these corporations. You know, what's next? Public radio? Absolutely, of course it is. I want to stay on the air. Actually, I'd be happy not being on the air. If it was a perfect world, I'd be out of business right now, wouldn't I? Okay, carrying on. Oh, you know what? These campus community updates, I've gotten a lot of support for this show and CHLY, which hosts it, obviously. Edmonton 9/11 Truth, Fraser Valley 9/11 Truth, and Victoria 9/11 Truth, all big sponsors of independent radio CHLY. Thank you. This show is brought to you in part by those fabulous groups. Okay, where do I want to go with that? I think I've taken care of just about everything there. I've thanked my supporters, and well, let's do it. Let's head back to this interview with John Bancor, Splitting the Sky, and right now we're talking about following the money trail. And John, are you there with
us?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. Thanks for hanging in.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. Did you want to carry on, or do you want to start at a fresh spot? You're doing such a fantastic job, and you're making my job pretty easy tonight. Fascinating to listen to. Where do you want to go, John?
Well, you know what? I want to get back just a little bit here. Morgan Reynolds was one of the chief economists under the administration.
That's right.
Huh?
That's right, yeah, and he's since become a whistleblower. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big whistleblower.
Yeah.
And has basically said, no, it was an inside job. And I want to – here's a question he posed, and I've got to throw a little jug in on my political nemesis there, Mr. Evil himself, Mr. Giuliani.
Okay.
And he asked this question about Giuliani in terms of Giuliani, because as you know, your listeners probably know, Giuliani was in the World Trade Building number 7, and in the World Trade Building number 7, he had the Office of Emergency Management. And Giuliani, on that particular whole floor, he rented from Larry Silverstein for $16 million a year.
Mm.
Now, imagine that. I believe that was Giuliani given New York City's money to Silverstein to couple it with the Blackstone in order to secure that lease. So I think that was part of that. But the Office of Emergency Management, that it was a bunker in the building number 7. And as you know, there's no explanation, you know, for building number 7 coming down except that it was imploded.
Yeah.
In fact, Silverstein himself said later on PBS documentary that they had to pull it.
Mm-hmm.
But Giuliani, now, see, what he has to understand is there was an operation that was also supposed to be set off for the following day. There was an operation called Operation Tripod. And what was supposed to happen is that on September 12, 2001, there was supposed to be the simulated attack by anthrax.
Yep.
And that the city was under a chemical attack, and they were supposed to go through this exercise of how were they going to get the people out, away from this terrorist attack. Well, I say that simulated attack was conveniently set up by Dick Cheney, who I believe was really the maestro behind behind setting up live drills that were going on that morning. And using software called P-TECH in order to not only to remotely control aircraft into those buildings, but to also use that P-TECH technology, that PROMIS software, in order to move the money that was being traded on Wall Street through a back door on this computer system. But basically, Giuliani, I believe that Operation Tripod was set up because they knew they were going to have FEMA agents floating all through the buildings at the Twin Towers. They would have to get FEMA there, and immediately they would have to be on set for the mop-up operation They would also have to be there to stop any kind of investigation from going on by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office or anybody or police homicides. That was a murder investigation that was going on there. Should have been. But they didn't. When they conveniently used that thermite to cut the metal into 30-foot sections, and when those buildings collapsed at free fall time, when those buildings collapsed, it made it very easy for those people to come in and just collect all of the evidence, put up yellow ribbons all around, you know, to cordon it off so that nobody could enter that. Giuliani wouldn't let anybody investigate that murder scene. Why? Because he was behind the murder. And a lot of people ask themselves, well, how come 100,000 people, notably people from Hollywood and famous individuals, was trying to get get Spitzer to investigate this murder scene? Well, it just so happens that Jerry Hauer and was also one of the managers of the Office of Emergency Management with Giuliani. Those were his two best friends, so he couldn't investigate his best friends in a murder involvement, you know, in orchestrating an inside job.
Yeah.
So that's why he never did. As a matter of fact, Spitzer was the one that wrote that had actually argued amicus curiae, or a friend to the court on behalf of Larry Silverstein for the lawsuit in order to collect the $5 billion from the tower. So Spitzer himself was involved. This is how intricate and dirty these politicians are, that they were involved. Now, I know when I was there with my family, when we were at the Marriott Hotel, I saw over 100 FEMA agents milling around. And I thought to myself, what the hell are they doing here? This was on September the 10th. Now, the FEMA executives during the 9/11 commission hearings are saying that they weren't there until September the 11th, which was a big, big lie. Now this is a statement that Morgan Reynolds made, and I about Giuliani.
Okay.
And I would like this to read this here quickly. He asked this question: why would the killers destroy WTC-7, especially since a collapse would arouse suspicion in some quarters? A logical, if unproven, theory is that the perpetrators used Mayor Giuliani's sealed Office of Emergency Management bunker on the 23rd floor of the WTC-7 to conduct the Twin Tower implosions and then destroyed the building and evidence to cover up their crimes, just as a murderer might set his victim's dwelling ablaze to cover up the crime. One in four fires is arson. Giuliani's undisclosed secret location was perfect because it had been evacuated by 9:45 a.m. on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
It enabled unmolested work, provided a ringside seat, was bullet and bomb resistant, had its own secure air and water supply, and could withstand winds of 160 miles per hour. Necessary protection from the wind blast generated by collapsing skyscrapers. Now,
there was also a number of other federal agencies in Building 7 as well that were worthy of evidence being destroyed.
Yes, as well as all of the computer documents of the Securities Exchange Commission on the put option stocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there it is.
So now... Now, how much time are we looking at here? We only have 2 minutes, right?
We got almost 20.
Almost 20?
Yep.
Okay. Well, you know, I was looking around the scanner and the net there, and I kind of got to a place there over the years now that where I have, you know, actually learned to use this computer, because I wasn't really necessarily computer savvy, but I've gotten pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out you could just Google just about anything, and you could ask a question, and you could almost get just about anything you want.
Yeah.
And so I was surprised to see that there were a number of different citizens' investigations that were done, and pretty much citizens' juries, right, that were assembled. And I came across this one that was called the San Diego Citizens Grand Jury.
That's right.
Have you heard of them?
Yeah, I reported it happened, I believe it was last summer.
You did. Did you critique all of the 16 people that that were listed on there?
I knew a lot of the names from being, you know, various professionals that have since become either whistleblowers or at least truth activists that sat on the panel.
Okay. Well, do you mind if I reiterate some of this information here?
Please
because
do.
Because I had dug up all this other information when I found out that the people that I had unearthed, you know, by way of other means, ended up on this particular list.
No, please do.
And so I just like to read this here. It says it was called the jurors vote to charge 16 with conspiracy to commit mass murder on 9/11/01. Convening on Saturday, April 14th, 2007, the 23-member San Diego Citizens Grand Jury on the crimes of September 11, 2001 in New York City heard more than 6 hours of presentations by Chief Prosecutor Don Paul, Chief Investigator Jim Hoffman, and expert witnesses Richard Gage, Ted Muga, Stephen Jones, and Kevin Ryan at the Student Council Chambers in the Aztec Center of San Diego State University. On the evening of that Saturday, the jurors voted by majority for 2 indictments and 14 presentments on the most consequential charge offered them, that of conspiracy to commit mass murder. The mass murder in question pertains to the death of more than 2,300 people due to the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings 1 and 2, the Twin Towers, on the morning of September 11, 2001. Jurors had seen much evidence that internal explosions must have caused the two 110-story skyscrapers to disintegrate into their footprints. They also seen records that more than incompetence had caused American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175 to escape interception by U.S. military on 9/11/01. Jurors called for a heavier charge than any officially offered by Chief Prosecutor Paul. Their own initiative, based on their knowledge from and before the day's many hours of proceedings, produced a far greater number of individuals wanted through presentment, 14, than the 2 posed by the prosecutor as deserving further investigation through indictment for the heavier or stronger charge. A presentment, according to the Columbia University Press Encyclopedia, is an accusation issued by the grand jury on its own knowledge without any bill of indictment having been previously drawn up by the prosecutor. Per the chief prosecutor's request for indictment, the 2 persons named by San Diego's grand jury as showing probable cause for further investigation on a charge of conspiracy to commit mass murder are Rudolph Giuliani, mayor of New York City on 9/11/01, Jerome Howard, managing director of Kroll, Inc., and senior advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services for National Security and Emergency Management on 9/11, former director of Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. Per presentment, based on jurors' knowledge without any bill having been previously drawn up by the chief prosecutor, the 14 persons named by the San Diego Citizens Grand Jury as showing probable cause for further investigation on the charge of conspiracy to commit mass murder are Thomas Pickard, acting director of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation from June 25, 2001 to September 4, 2001. Michael Cherasky, Chief Executive Officer of Kroll, Inc., 9/11/01, former investigator in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office from 1978 to 1974, current CEO of Marsh & McLellan Insurance Firm. Marsh & McLellan is one of the 38 on the control list, as a footnote. George W. Bush, President of the United States, 9/11/01. Larry Silverstein, CEO of Silverstein Properties, primary lease lender of the World Trade Center Twin Towers, a developer of the third skyscraper that disintegrated into its own footprint in Lower Manhattan on 9/11/01, World Trade Building 7. Richard Cheney, Vice President of the United States on 9/11/01. Donald Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense of the U.S., on 9/11/01. By the way, when Donald Rumsfeld told the world that they couldn't find $2.3 trillion were missing from the Pentagon, you know, where does $2.3 trillion go unless they basically helped the finance man 9/11?
Yeah.
It also, those records that would of the accountants that would have known where that was, what was in the section of the Pentagon that got blown up by a cruise missile.
Mm.
So all that was taken out conveniently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Marvin Bush, who, by the way, member of the board of direction, director of Securicom, a firm. Marvin Bush was George Bush's brother, and he was the head of security of the World Trade Centers. His contract ended on September 11, 2001. So he was there with his cousin, whose name is Wirt Walker, who's on this list here, mm-hmm. right, of Securicom. The two of them were there responsible for wiring up those buildings months in advance. Richard Myers, acting chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff on 9/11/01. Richard Eberhardt, commander of North American Aerospace Command, NORAD, on 9/11. Paul Bremer, executive with Marsh and McLellan, which is one of the list on the list of the 38 corporations. He was also one of the signers of the Project for a New American Century. This is something I'm ad-libbing right here, right now. And he was also, what was that, the first something over there, the first somebody over there in Iraq.
Hmm.
Chairman of the U.S. Congress on National Commission on Terrorism from 1999 to 2000. Peter G. Peterson, CEO of the Blackstone Group, parent corporation of one of three leaseholders for the World Trade 7, number 7, on 9/11/01, also chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations on 9/11/01. David Rockefeller, prime builder of the Twin Towers and all the World Trade Center complex, as chairman of the Downtown Lower Manhattan Association from 1958 to 1975, president or CEO of the Chase Manhattan Bank from 1961 to 1981, chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations from 1970 to 1985, Morris Greenberg, CEO of the American International Group, AIG, which is one of the 38 of the control list, that was banned by the Securities Exchange Commission for public consumption and also by that fraudulent blue ribbon panel known as the 9/11 Commission.
Mm-hmm.
On 9/11/01, AIG, the leading U.S.-based insurance organization and the largest underwriter of commercial and industrial insurance in the United States, according to its website in February 2000. AIG is also a major shareholder in Marsh McLellan, which is one of the 38, whose CEO on 9/11/01 was Maurice Greenberg's son, Jeffrey, a major investor, 7% in the Blackstone Group, the leading investor in Kroll, Inc., which became a subsidiary of Marsh & McLellan. This ties these crooks and criminals and mass murderers right into trading on Wall Street on the blood put option stocks.
I got 19. Is that how many is on the list?
How many is on the list? 16.
16. Oh, yeah. I counted 19, so I must have included some other names you dropped.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm surprised Condoleezza Rice wasn't in there.
Well, I'm sure she is.
Well, I mean, her cover-up came after with her proven, misstatements, lies to the commission.
Mm.
Hmm. Now, let me see. There's a Canadian name, a professor, Anthony Hall.
Yes.
And I'm bringing that up because you've got a fairly long connection with him, and he's going to be in Edmonton. He's pretty new to the 9/11 Truth Group.
Actually, I brought him into this.
There you go.
Yeah, he's a very good friend of mine.
Nice, nice. He's going to be speaking in Edmonton September 6th.
Yes.
This year, along with Kevin Barrett. I believe
yes.
You know Kevin as well.
Yes, I've been on the show a number of times.
There we go. So I just wanted to plug Edmonton's efforts there,
mm-hmm.
to bring in some truthers together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, let me see, it was the video, if... Oh, gee, I'm forgetting the proper title. I played a clip from it 2 weeks ago, a very powerful lecture in which you were at Simon Fraser University here in Vancouver.
Yeah, that was years ago, and again, that was right, that was rolling right off the cuff, man, just on my intuitive feelings.
That was 3 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And you came up with a term that's the first time I'd heard it. I'm not going to say you made it up, but anyways, it's a coincidence theorist.
Yeah.
And
I made that up.
Well done. Well done. That was fantastic. You know, you want to call me a conspiracy theorist? Well, guess what? I'm calling you a coincidence theorist.
Yeah.
Well done. That was a lot of fun and a lot of truth to it.
Yes.
Let me see. Where else can we go with this? Do you want to talk about, from what I understand, one of the reasons you're in Vancouver is that you're working on a film project. Do you want to get involved, talk about that? Or your experience behind that? I haven't asked you that personally, so I don't know.
My film, I'm tried out for a movie there. I'm an actor also.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I played. I was in the first two episodes, including the pilot of the TV series Men in Trees with Anne Hesch.
Okay.
A bunch of different TV shows. I've been in a movie. I was in a movie there with Lucas Black and Peter Coyote and Mia Maestro in a movie called Deepwater. It was a psychological thriller.
Okay.
I just tried out for a movie that would be co-starring there with Kris Kristofferson. So I auditioned for that movie.
Okay.
And I'm waiting for. It looks like I'm probably going to get that. I'm an aspiring actor.
Nice. Is there anyone that's coming to you? Are there any First Nations filmmakers that? You know, what your face or experience on there? I certainly hope so.
You know what? Too many people, man, say, you know, too many people are afraid, man, of my loud voice.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, people fear the truth.
Yeah,
you know,
they do.
Someday, you know, it's easier for people to wait till you're dead and then to create a legend out of you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of people don't like to confront you when you're a walking legend. You know what I'm saying?
Hmm.
They don't, you know, I don't bite my tongue, and I just, you know, I just basically see it, I call it like I see it, and that kind of truth is too scary for most people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that, and a lot of people, well, I hope not many, but, you know, have learned the hard way that, you know, I mean, there's a long history of, you know, professors, you talk about American foreign policy or, you know, whatever, you could be barking your career.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I'll tell you, the reason I am so involved in this right here is because, you see, like a lot of times the people ask, you know, like I'm really trying to create intervention by putting this truth out. FEMA has over 750,000 people marked for execution as political dissenters in North America.
What was that number again?
750,000.
Okay.
And I'm sure I'm high on their list. But I'm also trying to let FEMA know that there are old, you know, there's like in the United States, there's probably about 7 million gun owners, you know what I mean? That when they finally realize that it was an inside job, there are 7 million people out there that are not going to let the U.S. FEMA come down and throw them into concentration camps and to execute them.
Yeah.
Now, this is how real this is getting. You know, then and like I say, so I'm letting people know that those that were, you know, who the real criminals behind 9/11, because you can only dupe people so long with the lie, with the big lie.
Yeah.
So for me, it's cutting through the chase and getting right to who was behind it. And this way, when people wake up and they say, "Oh, wait a minute, you know, this ain't right."
You mentioned the guns, and a good example to bring up here would be Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
In which they went door to door and took guns.
And confiscated guns and violated, man, the United States people's Second Amendment, the right to defend themselves.
Yeah, it's a bit of a,
against the rise of tyranny.
Absolutely, you know, and that was a proving ground to, you know, how did it work? What did we learn? You know, how can we make it better next time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing little practice sessions, it seems.
Yes.
Are you following, well, it's kind of hard to say follow, but have you... Do you have much interest in the federal election in the States?
Well, I'm watching the dupe, but you know what? I just read an article by Wesley Tarpley.
Yeah.
On Obama, basically, and I thought it was really well written, and basically where he states that you got to keep an eye out for him because you know while the neocons that were behind 9/11. are basically they actually kind of pissed Soros and that whole crew off, you know, because the reason Soros has put out so much money, you know, to fight the Republicans and to get Bush out is because Bush kind of went headlong into his apoplectic role as the innovator, as the one that's going to bring on the cleansing, so to speak, Armageddon. This guy's really, really lost it, man, to this religious fanaticism. But in the background, but with Bush, is that see. A lot of people don't know that, like with Soros, he's put out a lot of money to the anti-war movement, and basically what he's done is that he implicates is that they want to do their dirty work, but they want to do it. They want to do it quietly,
mm-hmm.
and this is the way they always operate. And Bush and Cheney kind of brought them to the forefront. So,
they're a little in your face, yeah.
And so now they're all in the face, and it just makes it too easy for people like me to start investigating and seeing what's going on. But Tarpley says is you got to watch out. On the one hand, that the neocons are going out, and that basically Soros and Brzezinski and others, they're working to curb the the talk all the rumors or all of the anticipating of the Bush administration moving with Israel to bomb Iran and take Iran out. But what it seems like, as according to Tarpley, is that Brzezinski crew, who's now overcoming the trilateralists, are now taking over charge, and basically these other guys are just nothing but lame ducks right now, waiting out there, and they're moving with Obama to to make Iran an ally against Russia, and also to push Obama, man, to hype up the rhetoric, man, and then the attacks against Pakistan, so that they can knock off one of China's closest allies, you see. And so what these idiots are getting ready to do is to take us into a big, scary global nuclear confrontation. This is what's getting ready to go down. This is end game. This is end times.
Yeah.
And we got to watch for this, what's getting ready to go. So a vote for Obama really is a vote for the trilateralists. And again, I say Obama, is getting financing, man, from the same corporations, man, that were on the list of corporations that benefited from 9/11.
So,
now, a lot of people say, and Soros, was a lot of people want to say, why doesn't Amy Goodman, why doesn't Noam Chomsky, yeah. or why doesn't Naomi Klein, why don't these people, basically come right out and say 9/11 was an inside job?
That's a good question.
Why don't they investigate it? Why don't they debate it in public? Well, the reason that they don't is because all these people, especially Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky and Noam Solomon, all these people get finances, man, from the Ford Foundation, which is basically, man, money that's infused by Soros to keep their mouths shut.
Yeah.
So they get hush money.
Yeah. It sure seems that way. I mean, the pretty intelligent people that you just listed, and for them to just play, play the coincidence theory game.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I mean, look at Naomi Klein, her shock doctrine, and you talk about disaster capitalism, and she can talk about all the same thing, that they benefit, man, from all these environmental, geographical, and political, and economic shocks that come down, catastrophes that come down.
Yeah.
And yet she won't. She says 9/11 wasn't an inside job.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book, and she comes 75% honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, of course, you see, just like the anti-war movement and a lot of these people that are in the so-called that are on the so-called left. I mean, all one has to do is read, the Left Gatekeepers by, I forget his name right now.
I'm not re-
but check it out, the Left Gatekeepers, and you can see how all of this is connected, where the money's connected. And why these people will not allow 9/11 people, men truthers, man, in to speak the truth about what's really going on.
Yeah, yeah.
They won't broach the subject because, one, they'll lose their funding. And also, they also most people just don't really want to believe it was an inside job. But, of course, we've got a whole history of false flag operations that have happened, from the Gulf of Tonkin, man, to the Lufthansa, to Pearl Harbor and wherever.
There's a long list, absolutely.
There's a long list of them.
One of my first teachers was a lot of I lived in Southern California, and black hip hop artists. You know, these angry, informed young men talking about the terrible conditions of the inner city.
Yeah.
I don't want to necessarily name names, but a lot of them now, you see them making movies, and well, they're smiling pretty good now because they've got big fat wallets.
Yeah.
You know, that's another way to you hang a huge carrot in front of them, and I hope that doesn't happen to you if your career sparks off. I'm sure it won't.
No, it won't. You know, I have to speak the truth the way I have to speak the truth, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah. You know what? We're getting ready to say goodbye. I would like to ask if there's a final thought or a word you want to conclude with.
Well, I'd just like to say thanks to your listeners for bearing with us here. Yeah. And if you're interested in getting a copy of my autobiography, please give me a call at 604-255-1369 till at least for one more week.
Okay.
Or you can go call me at 250-679-7743 when I get back after a week. And you can also contact me if you at splittingthesky@yahoo.com.
Yeah, yeah. Also, again, for those that want to hear more, a fantastic speech that you gave at the Canadian-U.S. border, the Peace Arch Park for the Northwest Truth Convergence. That went down a couple weeks ago. Again, Google, from Google Video, Splitting the Sky Speaks Truth to Power is the title, and that'll take you there. I'm also going to put that, I'll link it on my website. So I think that is about it.
Well, it's been great being on your show, my friend.
Thank you very much. The pleasure is mine, and best of luck in your truth work and in your career work. You know, best of luck to you, my friend.
Yes, and if there's anybody also would like to bring me out that way to do a talk at universities or anything like that, I'm also open for that.
Very nice.
Have a good evening.
Thank you very much. Okay. Boy, that was exciting, and that was Splitting the Sky, John Bancor. Speaking on the money trail, follow the money in 9/11. So that will do it for another episode of Unbought and Unbossed on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Do I have any final words? Dad, is there a final thought for you? My father's been sitting in.
That was an outstanding program.
Hey, Dad said it was an outstanding program. I think you're biased. Okay, thanks, Dad, and thanks, listeners. I'm going to send us off with a song, Wish List, by Pearl Jam, and I know that we all have a pretty big wish list, getting Canada out of Afghanistan, practicing a little bit of sovereignty, you know, not doing what the corporations are forcing our politicians to do. So have a great week, and we'll see you again next week. Thank you.